Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Living in Denver podcast, where we answer your questions as a home buyer or an owner, or if you're thinking about moving here from out of state. And, you know, this week we're going to shake it up a little bit differently. Normally, you know, every other week we have Chris Lawhead on, my trusted mortgage broker, and then we have other guests sprinkled in every other week. But this week I'm running solo, and because it's spring, a lot of us are getting extremely busy, and so schedules have been a little bit tougher, but I've also had a lot of buyers come to me, specifically younger buyers, that have had a lot of the same concerns that I really wanted to address. And we'll address some more of them with other guests that I have, but I really wanted to hammer in and dial in deep. So if you are a first-time home buyer, a younger home buyer looking to move here from out of state, pay attention to this podcast closely. If you're watching, you're going to see some numbers that we throw on the screen. If you're just listening, I'll do my best to explain exactly what we're looking at. So right now, it's the middle of March, approximately. Okay, springtime has really started. Buyers are coming out of the woodworks, but these interest rates are still pretty elevated, and that's putting a lot of sellers in the position of not wanting to sell their place. So we don't have a ton of inventory coming online, and so it's not making it very buyer friendly. So I went to a trusted authority, ChatGPT, and it pulled up some of the most common concerns that you have as first-time home buyers, as young home buyers, or heck, any home buyers. I have a lot of older clientele that haven't bought or sold a property in 20 to 30 years, and they're looking at downsizing. And to be honest with you, they're facing a lot of these same struggles, except they may not be able to adapt as well as you younger folks do. So we're going to go through a top 10 list of the most common things, questions, concerns that you have out there. And again, you know, if you're not subscribed, you know, we just try to give you the no BS, no frills answers to specifically the Denver market. I've been in the industry since 2010, started out flipping homes mostly, and then transitioned more into traditional real estate. Today, I do both, helping buyers and sellers in the multi-million dollar luxury price ranges, as well as people wanting to buy a fixer-upper. You know, there's nothing that's cheap in Denver. I'm not one of those agents to, you know, just cherry pick what kind of clientele I want to work with. I tend to work with people that I jive with really well, and we create long-lasting relationships over time. And so getting to this list, let's just jump right into it. And it starts off with probably the most common question on everybody's mind, or concern, is affordability. You know, Denver, and I'm going to show you this screen for those of you that are watching here. Denver has experienced significant growth in its real estate market over the last couple of decades, I would say, since the last crash. Now, to be fair, the entire market has done that across the entire country. And so we are not immune, you know, or the only ones to experience a rapid growth. However, our growth is substantially faster than most other places in the country. And it's an extreme concern, but we do have something that does help out. So when I talk to a lot of people, you know, the first step that most people have in looking for a house is to look at houses without truly understanding what they can afford. Maybe they've gone to a simple calculator to see, you know, what they might be able to afford, but it might not include all the, you know, details, all the nuances of maybe your debts, maybe your credit card payments, car payments, insurance, things of that nature that are on top of just your regular, you know, housing needs. And so it's one of the biggest mistakes I see people make with affordability is just not knowing what they can actually afford. And until you know that number, you shouldn't be doing anything else, okay? I know that might seem like a cop-out, but I'm telling you from experience, you're gonna go out and look at houses, you're gonna find something that you're in love with, and then you're not gonna be able to afford that house, and that house will haunt you the rest of your lives. Ask me how I know. Me and my wife, we've done that before. And it's kind of painful. Now, granted, we weren't exactly in the market for a house at the time, but once we saw this house, we went, oh God, like it fit exactly what we were wanting. And we talk about, there's actually a couple of them that we talk about over the years. But I wanted to show you and break down some calculators here just to give you an idea what affordability actually is, okay? So to start off with, the median home price in Denver as of the end of February 2024 is exactly $550,000, okay? That's single families, that's condos, that's townhomes, that's everything. That's just the median price of everything that is closed in the Denver metro area for the month of February, $550,000. Not as high as what a lot of people think, first of all. Not everything costs $1 million in the Denver market, but how much do you actually need to make to afford a $550,000 house? And starting with the down payment, most people assume that you have to have a 20% down payment. Now, we're going to run numbers based on a 20% down payment, but you don't. You can have 5% as a conventional. You can have 3.5% as an FHA down payment. So you don't have to have this huge lump sum of money to buy your house, but it does affect your monthly payment. So let's just break it down. And starting with the average or median home price of $550,000, let's say you did have 20% down, which would be $110,000. On a 30-year fixed mortgage at 7% interest rate, which is likely what you'll get approved for if you have decent credit today, with property taxes. Now, this is the big one, ladies and gentlemen. This is what no one else really talks about. Colorado has the third lowest property tax rate in the country, which means your dollar goes a lot further to the house. Let's take parts of Texas, parts of Illinois, New York, for example, Florida, their property taxes are very high. So you could pay 10 grand a year in property taxes in parts of Texas and most of Illinois, and that's all purely towards property taxes. That's, you know, $800 a month in payments and property taxes, where we are about 0.5% of the value of the home. So if you own a home at $500,000, you can expect to pay a little bit under $2,500 a year in property taxes. So how this shakes out is, going back to our numbers here, is once we put in property tax and we put in homeowners insurance, we're not going to put in any HOA fees, just to keep things simple. We can see that, all right, to buy a $550,000 house, you're going to have to be able to afford basically $3,350 a month on a mortgage payment. That's a fair chunk of change. But at the same time, rent on most houses isn't much below $3,000 these days. If you're in the market, you know, if you want a decent house, you got to pay for it, especially if you want to be in, you know, the more desirable parts of the Denver metro area. Now, how much do you need to make to afford this payment? Well, I came over here to our affordability calculator, and you really just kind of have to fudge with this, okay? So I had to reverse engineer the numbers, putting in the down payment of $110,000 on a 30-year fix at 7% interest rate, all the same numbers. The annual income has to be $112,000 to be able to afford that $550,000 home, okay? Now, if you do want to put down, let's say, the minimum down payments, so your monthly payment is going to be adjusted upwards, right? Because you're putting less down, so you're borrowing more money. You also have to pay PMI, which is on top of your mortgage. So it's mortgage insurance is what that's called, because it's a little bit of a higher risk loan that the bank is making. So they charge you more. So they punish you for not having as much money, right? That's kind of how it shakes out. So now let's go back here and looking at that $550,000 home with a down payment of, let's say, 5%, because that's the minimum down for most conventional loans. At 7% interest rate, you might pay a little bit more. Property taxes, homeowners insurance are going to be the same. That shakes out to being a $3,900 a month payment, okay? So significantly more. Now, when we come back to our affordability calculator, we need to plug in our new down payment, which is $27,500, okay? And then we have to adjust the annual income to match what the affordability is. So essentially, you have to make $130,000 a year with a $27,500 down payment on a $550,000 home. Okay. So that is the reality here. And I know it's not the most comfortable thing. I don't like it per se, but there are more inexpensive areas if you get a little bit further out. South Aurora is going to get you a lot more home for your money than, you know, Wash Park or Platte Park or, you know, DU area. Like, you really have to kind of balance your wants and needs and maybe put aside the things that you want now for things that maybe are more important within the next 5 years of your life, okay? But that's the reality of the affordability. It's not extremely affordable here, but with those property taxes, it's actually a little bit more than a lot of the cities out there, especially on the East Coast. That makes a big difference. So make sure you check with your lender, your mortgage broker, on what your real number is before you start this process, because it might be a little bit better than you think. Going on to point number two here. Is the competitive market. You know, every headline you hear out there is about multiple offers and, you know, how crazy the market is and no one's putting their home on the market for sale. And it can be really off-putting as a first-time home buyer. Well, I'm going to give you a tip and a trick to get around this completely, because there's a psychology out there that I have learned over the past 15 years in this business. Is that it's a mob mentality, and I have fallen victim to it myself. When we were looking for a home back in 2020, 2021, we fell into the same scenario where we were missing out by $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 offers over asking price. And I look back, and it might be the best thing that ever happened that we got beat out on these homes. I look back at the homes that we put the offers on, and three out of the four would not have worked properly for us. They would not have been a right fit today in our lives. So we would have had extreme buyer's remorse had we gotten all wrapped up. Well, we were wrapped up in that hype, but had we succeeded in stretching ourselves beyond the point of comfort and getting a house that didn't work. Forget the monthly payment for a second. Interest rates were really low. That would have been fine for us, but the actual, you know, functionality of the house would have been wrong. But there is a way around this, and it's not what people want to do. So the psychology is that any new home on the market, we got to go see. Oh, let's go check it out. Let's go look. You know, we got to go now. We got to get in our offer now. No, you don't. The most success I have with home buyers is to look at inventory that's been on the market for 2 weeks or more. Okay. Why? Well, if it's been on the market for 2 weeks or more, it's either A, might be overpriced, B, might, you know, be a little bit less desirable, or C, they just kind of missed, you know, when they listed. If they listed on a holiday weekend, which are notoriously slow, they might not have gotten any traction, and now they're getting a little nervous, right? They've had one or two showings, time is going by. No activity is happening. Meanwhile, all the headlines out there are saying how everything's selling for $100,000 over asking. Oh, that's a load of BS, folks. On average, the close price to list price, and actually, let's look at the number and see what it is, because there's a very real number. So what this says is percentage of close price to list price today is 100%, meaning the close price on average is closing at the asking price. Last month, it was at 99.3%, meaning that every house was selling for 0.7% less on average than what they were being listed for. Only back, you got to go back to 2022, where it was 4.9% over asking is what people were paying. That's not the case today, you know? So if you want to actually take advantage, maybe ask for a seller concession. Maybe know that you can have an inspection objection where the seller's going to work with you. Start by looking at the houses that have been on the market for 2 weeks or more. That is my best advice for you. Some stuff is getting multiple offers, but not all of it. I would say half of the stuff out there is getting multiple offers right now on the market, but not all of it. No rhyme or reason. This is not the last 2 years, ladies and gentlemen. It is not the craziness that we have had, at least not yet this year. All right, on to point number three, down payment and financing. So we've covered this a little bit, but it seems pretty common that most people don't know that you can put down 3.5% on an FHA loan, 5% on a conventional, 20% just gets you to the point where you get the lowest rate and you get rid of that PMI on your monthly payments. So it is the most affordable, but you don't need to do that, especially if you're young folks. Get into the market. That's the best advice I can give you. Get into it. In 5 to 10 years, you will thank me, as everybody has over the last 100 years that has ever bought a house. And so other than that, if you're looking further out from the Denver metro area, you can take advantage of programs like USDA. If you're a veteran, you can take advantage of having a VA loan, which is 0% down. So once again, if you don't know what you're capable of, you need to ask a professional, ask an expert, ask a trusted source, because they're going to tell you what you can and cannot do, and be a guide to you along this journey. All right. Number four, housing inventory. Housing inventory is very low, ladies and gentlemen. Let's just go ahead and take a look here. So I'm looking at a chart right now of the last 15 years of inventory in the Denver market. And every year this time in the spring, our inventory is the lowest and buyer demand is really starting to ramp up. Our inventory is generally highest in July. So we can look at this chart and it looks like a heartbeat for those of you that are listening. We have the most inventory in the summer months. We have the least inventory from January to February. And we can see in 2024, you know, in February, we had 9,700 units, homes on the Denver Metro MLS. Well, what does that mean? How many are actually selling? Well, we're selling last month 4,500 of them. So we literally sold 50% of everything that was on the market. And that's just kind of the norm as it has been over the last 10 years. So it is tough to have your list of wants and needs and not maybe be able to find it. It might take you 3 months, 6 months, 9 months to find a home that you love. Okay. And you have to be willing to be patient. No home is better than a bad home. Okay. Remember that. No home is better than a bad home that doesn't serve your needs. No home is better than a bad home. Remember that, ladies and gentlemen. No home is better than one that does not serve your needs. Okay. On to number five, future value. This is a good one because lots of people do worry about what's going to happen in the future. And you know what? I'll be the first to admit it. I've been wrong about the market over the last 3 years. I thought we were going to crash once COVID hit. I mean, the economy shut down for crying out loud. Like, we just had no idea. And since then, I've been on the fence. I've been teetering back and forth a little bit, like, you know, oh gosh, we're going to crash and burn, or no, things are going to be okay and we're going to go up, up and away. And I've gotten to the point where I've stopped, right? I've been wrong long enough, but that hasn't driven my decisions, right? What drives my decisions is the numbers of foreclosures, which are very few and far between. So there's no red flag indicator there. The numbers of buyers, the numbers of properties coming to the market, you know, for the people who have said, you know, this is going to be another 2008. In 2008, there was 5 times more inventory on the market and we were selling the same amount of homes as today. Okay. So if you put your house on the market in 2007, 2008, there was an expectation that it would take 6 to 12 months to sell your house. That was just reality. 5 times more inventory on the market. Today, we've got, 9,000? We had over 40,000 homes. We had 45, 50,000 homes on the market back in 2008. But most of us don't really remember, you know, what that was. We were all too young to really be too plugged in to know what the inventory was like at that time. And that's just the reality. So the future value, getting back to that point, can be a concern. But what I've learned is that you cannot time this market. There's only been a handful of years in the last 100 years that real estate prices have actually declined. Okay. And 2008 and 2009 were two of those, two out of like the 4 or 5 years. And so you buy because we have this incredible program where you can get a locked-in rate, which most countries don't have, by the way. Canada does not have conventional loans that have a locked rate, where we do. So if you can afford the monthly payment, right, make sure that it's within your means and you're comfortable with it, and then you ride out the storm, right, if it does happen. But there's a very good chance that it won't happen, and no one knows. No one. The smartest people in the world have all been wrong since 2015. Everybody's been calling for a crash since 2015. Since 2015, we're up 100, 150% in property values across the entire country. It's all just clicky, baity, headliney stuff to get your ears, to get your eyeballs. And at the end of the day, it doesn't leave you feeling any better knowing that your investment is secured. You're going to be paying somebody's mortgage, whether you rent it or you own it, period. So owning it, at least you have some advantages on making yourself financially free in years to come. Okay. Location and commute. This is an interesting one too, because depending on where you're from, Denver could either be a really accessible city or it could be a poorly planned out city. I'm from Chicago originally, as you may know, where lots of people take public transportation. When I lived in the city proper, I didn't even have my car down there, right? It was a pain in the butt. You didn't want to park anywhere. You took the train, you took the bus a handful of blocks over to the train station, you took the train wherever you went. It still took you 30 to 45 minutes to get there, but it would have taken you longer to drive. And so that was just a reality. Public transportation here is not really a driving force for where people live and where people buy. The bus system is moderate. The train system is lacking, but a number of people do use them. But you really got to just be going north and south to use the train system there. So commuting wise, everybody owns a car. You just kind of have to own a car to get around, or just expect it to take you 45 minutes to get anywhere. That's, I think, the reality. Location wise, you know, I honestly would say there's not a bad part of Denver to be a buyer in, okay? There's some less desirable parts. You know, there's Globeville and Swansea, parts of East Colfax that aren't great, you know? But I said that 10 years ago, and I have a friend who bought at Colfax and Tamarack area, and she was able to afford under $200,000 at the time. And today that house is worth $500,000+. So, you know, take it as you will, but sometimes you got to buy where you don't want to buy in order to get you where you want to get to in the next 5 to 10 years of your life. And if you're young, you need to take advantage of that. Live in the condo, live in the townhouse, live in the single family home in a less desirable part. Because you got to remember, if the less desirable parts of Denver are still $400,000 to $500,000 for a single family home, who can afford a $400,000 to $500,000 house? These aren't being bought as rentals anymore. Like, the rental numbers don't shake out and don't make sense. I know this firsthand because I crunch those numbers all day, every day. And they don't work in single family Denver homes much anymore at all. So who else is buying them? You know, people making north of $115,000 to $130,000 a year. That's who's buying them. So it's going to transition as the rentals get sold off, as our parents' generation, who owns a lot of those rentals, are getting too old to manage them. They are selling them off. They are going to first-time home buyers, and the neighborhoods are transitioning. That's exactly what's happening. The cheapest parts of Denver have the most appreciation over the shortest period of time. Okay. So if you can suck it up and live where you don't want to live for 3 to 5 years, then you're going to be able to sell that place, put down $100,000 on a house that you want where you want to live. Okay. All right. On to number 7, property condition. First-time home buyers, young home buyers, knowing what condition a house it is in is a valid concern. Most of these houses were built in the 50s and 60s. And so because of that, there's a lot of aged major systems in the house. And by major systems, I mean things like your roof, your HVAC, your electrical. The windows do fall under majors because they're majorly expensive, depending on what you put in. And so they're not built up to today's standards. That's just the thing. There are some things that are better. The concrete is usually better. The framing is usually better. But it might be plaster walls. It might be galvanized pipes for your water, which over time you have a half-inch pipe that you end up with like this pea-sized hole of water getting through because galvanized pipe rusts. That's just a reality. So all you can do is do your due diligence when you have a house under contract. And that's by hiring a good home inspector, doing a sewer scope, which is never negotiable. You always do a sewer scope, getting a radon test. If that's something that is, you know, that you've looked up and you've decided that you want to get, we do have high levels of radon here, but having a good home inspector, check through your house, which is an unlicensed profession, by the way. So that adds another level of risk, but this goes back to having your trusted source, the right agent, the right lender. These people should be helping you through this. We do this every single day. Okay. You do this once every 5 to 10 years. We totally get that. You should not know how to do this by yourself. And no one's expecting you to. And you should be able to lean on your trusted sources. And if for 1 second you don't feel like your best interest is at heart, get a different person to help you. Period. There are ways around it. Now, if you're under contract already, yeah, maybe you're stuck. Maybe you got to let the house go. You should never have to sacrifice your earnest money. But yeah, having the right team of people to help you through the process is going to make this either a great experience or the most stressful thing that you've ever done in your life. All right, number 8 is understanding the process. Okay, so we just kind of covered this. Having the right team in your back pocket is your guide. Having the right agent that sets the expectations, you know, prior to doing anything. When I sit down with clients and we kind of have our intake, especially on the buy side, it's a little bit different on the sell side. It's setting the proper expectations because you already have an idea in your head of how this process is going to go. And I can promise you it's probably wrong. Okay. The reality is that step number one is to talk to a lender. Let's just go through the process real quick. Okay. This will just break it all down for you in a real easy to understand manner. Step number one is to talk to the lender or the mortgage broker to find out how much you're capable of buying based on your down payment, based on your credit score, based on all of your debts that are out there. Be honest with them. It's like talking to a doctor. You got to tell them the truth or else you're going to fall into a situation later where you might actually lose money and sacrifice your earnest money because you withheld things from the lender. Once you find out how much you can afford, make sure that that's in your comfort zone of your monthly payment. They might say, hey, you can afford up to $4,000 a month in a monthly payment, but in reality, you only feel comfortable with $3,200 a month. Then you got to reset your budget on what you're looking for. Now, let's say your budget is up to $550,000. Okay, let's just use the median price. When you talk to your agent, so next, and you should be talking to your agent, talking to them both at the same time, they should set up a search for you on what works for you. Now, I know you're on Redfin. I know you're on Zillow and Trulia and homes.com and all this stuff. And you're just scrolling through and just, you know, throwing a dart at the board to see like, ooh, what do I like? And getting attracted to pictures and all this stuff. But it should be much more scientific than that. Okay. You should have your areas picked out. Okay. And yes, your budget probably determines what parts of the city that you can live in. If you can afford $550,000, you're not going to be living in Wash Park unless you want one of the condos on the north side of the park. That's the reality. You're not going to be living in Platt Park. You're probably not going to be living in most of DU. You might have a few options in University Hills down south. Downtown, you're going to have some options, but they're going to be condos. You might be looking in Thornton or North Glen or East Colfax area, most of Aurora. But $550,000 in North Aurora gets you a whole lot less than it does in South Aurora. So stack on top of that your wants and needs. And you and your partner, if you're buying your home with somebody else, should have your list of wants and needs written down. And you should only have 6 wants total, 3 for each of you. Okay, that could be the amount of bedrooms, that could be the amount of bathrooms or garage spaces or having a yard, your very basics. If on your wants list is a walkout office space in the front of the house, you're never going to find it. Okay. Just get rid of it. Your wants are very basic, or your needs are very basic, I should say. Your wants, you can add a handful more, but you're never going to find your 100% house. Okay. You're looking for your 80% house. Location is more important than many other things. If you end up buying on a busy road in a neighborhood you want to live on, in a neighborhood you want to live in, like you, it might be a nightmare for you either way, because getting in and out of your driveway could suck. It could take you 10 minutes to get out of your darn driveway, for crying out loud. So really have that dialed in. From there, you should be going from hundreds of houses to maybe dozens of houses, okay? And then from dozens of houses, you should be going down just to a handful that you really want to look at. Your goal as a buyer is to not look at more than 5 to 10 houses in person. Okay? I'm going to repeat that. Your goal as a buyer is not to look at more than 5 to 10 houses in person. Why? Because, first of all, you're going to burn everybody out, right? If you're looking at 30, 40, 50 homes, then that means your wants and needs are not narrowed down enough on paper, and you're just kind of shooting in the wind. You're just kind of seeing what you like and what feel is out there and whatnot. That's the wrong way to do it. You're not going to buy a house if you do that, okay? It's just not going to happen. And so you should know if on paper this house works for you. Going in person is to make sure that it has the right vibes for you, right? The right feel. You get a feel when you walk into a house. Trust that feeling. Trust it 100% of the time. If you walk in and you got a bad feeling right off the bat, you're done. Like, don't keep going in that house. Turn around, walk out, you're done. If you get a good feeling, it's worth investigating a little bit more. How are the bathrooms laid out? How are the bedrooms laid out? If you have a kid, are the bedrooms on the same level? Or are you going to, you know, is there a primary on the main level and then all the other bedrooms on the second level? Like, how are you going to be situated? How is the yard situated? And so really, you know, understanding this process is going to just help you be successful in buying a home. And so once you have your wants and needs, your list figured out, you're going to start touring some homes. Great. You're going to find the one that you love. From there, you're going to put an offer together with a pre-approval that your agent will send to the listing agent. There are two agents in the deal. There's the listing agent and there's the buyer's agent. The buyer's agent represents you. The listing agent represents the seller. Both of our goals are to help our clients get to the end goal, which is the seller sells and the buyer buys. And both parties need to feel like they won. Okay. This isn't like a, you know, some 1970s stock market movie where, you know, you got to beat each other up and it's all these intense negotiations. No, most of the time, 90% of the time, it can be extremely friendly. And everybody is friendly to each other in the beginning because the buyer loves the home. The seller is going, yay, someone's willing to give me $600,000 for this thing. This is friggin' awesome because I bought it for $100,000, you know, back in the 90s. Like, both parties are happy. And then once you get under contract, the inspection happens, okay? There's usually two big hurdles to any contract, and that's going to be inspection, which is the biggest one by far, and then the appraisal, okay? The inspection is where you hire someone to inspect the home, every single outlet, light switch, the HVAC, the roof, all that stuff, and they come back with a 70-page report and scare the crap out of you about how bad the house is. Warning. That is the inspector's job, is to find things that are wrong. It could be a new build house for $4 million that was finished yesterday with all city permits and everything, and there could still be dozens of things that a home inspector will find. Why? It's their job, right? And they might be little things, and they could be big things. And so from there, you really just got to navigate what's worth asking for. If you're in a really competitive market, you're probably not going to get $30,000 to $50,000 worth of stuff. You're probably not going to get a new furnace and a new water heater and a new sewer line and a new roof. And by the way, repaint that back bedroom. Like, no, get rid of the painting. First of all, cosmetic stuff, you're probably not asking for. I don't think I've ever had a buyer or a seller approve a cosmetic update in the process of selling the house. Roofs are a major deal. Sewer lines are a major deal. Furnaces are a big deal. I wouldn't say major. Water heaters are very minor. Okay. So you want to kind of structure things as to what is the actual most important things to you as a buyer. And then you got to calculate in price. If you're buying a $600,000 house where everything else sells for $700 in the neighborhood, Well, they might have priced it appropriately, and they might be more sticklers on not giving you anything on the inspection objection. So you got to remember that. But this is where everything gets a little gritty and people start hating each other and making judgments about the other party in the deal. And our job as agents is to make sure that everybody keeps their cool, that we are putting out fires, that we are making sure that everybody understands what the expectations are going forward. So after that, then, you've got to jump through all your hoops with the lender. They're going to ask you for stuff on a whim, new credit card statements right off the bat, like, hey, we need this by tomorrow morning, first thing. Do it. Do it. It's a whole lot of hurry up and wait in this process. And then you're going to have an appraiser come out, and they're going to appraise the property. I would say in the last 15 years, I've only had two or three properties that haven't appraised at the value of the property. And so it really hasn't been that big of a deal, but there can be some hoops to jump through, especially if you're using an FHA loan. They do have a list of requirements. VA is a smaller list of requirements. Conventional doesn't really have that list of requirements. That just has to be habitable. Okay. So once again, ask your broker about that. And they'll be able to guide you through the different loan types and, you know, what requirements the appraiser may have. Once the appraisal is done and turned in, really you're just waiting for the clear to close. And this process takes approximately 30 days in total. The first week is the inspection, inspection objection, resolution, negotiating through that. Week number two, towards the end of it, is generally when you'll have your appraiser out. You'll get that appraisal back in week three usually. And then at the end of week four is generally when you're closing. And that's really it. Keys are handed over. Most of the time, you will not sign with the seller and buyer in the same room. I haven't had one of those closings in 5 years, 6 years now or so. And so it's okay not to meet the other party of the transaction during this process, which feels strange to some people, but it also keeps emotions at bay. Selling a house can be extremely emotional. Okay. And you don't want to go in as a buyer poking, you know, and asking all these questions and stuff. Meanwhile, you know, they're in tears at the closing table because they're signing over their family house. Okay. Buying a home is more fun than selling a home. I'll tell you that much. Now, on to number nine is the economics and stability of the job market here in Denver. We are a big tech hub. Okay. We are a huge tech hub. If you've never been here, just look up the Denver Tech Center. You're going to see the most major companies in the world are here in Denver. We are centrally located in the country. We're a great hub for logistics. Things like UPS and FedEx, DHL, all come through here and have major warehouses here. And then there's the construction market, which is bonkers right now. You can come here if you know any trade and get paid north of $100 an hour. If you're a plumber, you know furnaces, you're an HVAC guy, electrician, you name it. Even a painter, for crying out loud, they're getting $100 an hour here. So the job market, from my aspect, and I see tons of contractors, tons of people in the tech space, right? Real estate has a lot of tech involved in it, and it's fairly solid. Our unemployment rate is super low, and there's a reason for it. We're a super desirable place to be, you know? So even if shit hit the fan and the market did dump, like, I would have no reason to want to live anywhere else. We've got the mountains right outside our back door. We got tons of fresh water and are in control of a lot of the water for the West Coast. So I feel pretty comfortable about that. And we have tons of open space around us. So, you know, I like it. I like it a lot. I like our location. And stability wise, like, we're on the up and up in general, all along the Front Range, because we're just a fantastic place to live. People want to be here just to be here, not for any other reason other than to be here. So I'm fairly comfortable with our stability. And number 10, interest rates. Interest rates have a huge impact on the market. Interest rates drop a half a point, buyer activity spikes up. Interest rates go up a point, buyer activity dies. Okay, so pay attention to this cycle. And I've got some pro tips here for you, okay? On top of looking for homes that have been on the market for 2 weeks or more, the best thing you can do as a buyer is position yourself in the off-peak times, okay? Everybody wants to buy a home in the spring. Don't be that buyer, okay? If you have to, like, most of the inventory comes on the market in the spring, like, towards the end of spring. I get that. If you're more of your traditional family, you know, that's moving, the kids got to, you know, be transferred to a different school. Yeah, you want to do it in mid to late spring on the purchase, so that way you can sell your house in the summer months, potentially, wherever you're moving from. And it could be an easy transition for the entire family to happen in June, maybe July. But that's when everybody wants to do it. So if you can, be a buyer from September, October, until about January, when other buyers are off the fence. They don't want to. It's the holidays. No one buys a house during the holidays. The people who buy a house for through the holidays buy it at 10% less, 5 to 10% less, than they do the rest of the year, okay? Again, I'm going to repeat that. Buyers who buy during the holidays buy 5 to 10% less than the rest of the year. You want proof? Let me show it to you here. So I'm going back to the MLS, and we're going to pull up closed price. Okay, this is a map of the last 15 years. This is a graph of the last 15 years in the Denver market. Now, I know what you're saying. Oh, 2020, everything was super high, and then, yeah, we dropped down by 15%. Let's go back prior to COVID, okay? Let's go back to May and June of 2018, okay? Regular year, market's still just plugging along, chugging along, doing its thing. No way that we had any sort of crazy adjustment. Well, in June of 2018, the median sales price was $410,000 in the Denver metro area. Fast forward a few months, and in January of 2019, so 6 months later, it was $385,000. That's $25,000, $35,000 difference from June until January. That's 8%, 9% difference. Okay, maybe that was an anomaly. You guys seeing this on the screen, you're going, oh my gosh. Yeah, he's got a point. June of 2016, okay? That was when they started really calling for, oh, the market's going to crash. $360,000 was the median price in Denver in June of 2016, and it went down to $342,000. So 360 down to 342 was what, $18,000, $17,500? So that's 5%, right? Every single year, folks, like clockwork, the market goes from its high in May and June, and it goes down 5 to 10% by December, January, every single year. Let's pull out, you know, another one. Let's go to 2022. This was the big extreme one. It was $600,000 in April, went all the way down to $520,000 in January of 2023. That was a 15% adjustment. Okay, what about last year? Well, June and July were both the peaks at 575. Now, a tip here, or a point I should say, is that the peak was in June and July, but that means those houses to go under contract went under contract 30 to 60 days ago, okay? Remember that. When we hit the peak, it's already 30, 60 days late, okay? So June and July were at 575. We went down to 535. So that's a $40,000 difference from July of this year to December of this year. So what is that number? 7.5% drop? This is cyclical, folks. So if you're a seller, best months to sell are going to be the spring months, March, April, into May. Okay. As a buyer, the best months to buy are going to be your winter months, essentially, right? But you have a lack of inventory, and so it's not all rosy and like, oh, this makes perfect sense all the time. The difference between that 5 to 10% might make a difference between where you want to live versus where you can live. And also, in the spring months, it might be, you know, the difference between a house that you love versus, you know, settling in a house that you don't exactly love in the winter months. So if you love the home, as long as you can afford it, do it, make it right, make sure it's within your means. I struggle with the younger population and what's going to happen in the next 20 to 40 years, okay? If our prices keep going up like this, like, are you going to have to be able to make $300,000-$500,000 a year just to afford an entry-level home in the Denver market? Hopefully not, but I don't know how it doesn't go that direction. And if you want to know how bad it can get, look at San Francisco, look at Toronto, look at New York. They have crazy prices that are three times higher here in the Denver metro area. And so can it go further? Yeah, it actually can. So if you have any questions, you know, I'm here. Feel free, reach out, give me a call, shoot me a text message. My phone number is here below. For those of you that are listening, 303-552-4804 is my direct cell phone number. Feel free to reach out. I'm happy to take your calls. And until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, happy housing.